Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to this morning's study session from the Mesa City Council for Thursday, April 18th, 2013. Councilwoman Higgins, are you on the phone?
Good morning, Mayor.
Yes, she is. Okay. The first item on the agenda is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the following two proposed major general plan amendments. Amendment number one and amendment number two. I guess that would make two.
This morning, helping us out. Good morning, Mayor and Council. Each year, we have the opportunity to consider major amendments to our general plan. And want to give you just a little bit of background because I don't think we did one last year, and I can't remember if we did one the year before or not. But basically, state statutes give some basis for it, and then our own general plan sets out the rest of the process and procedures. Within our general plan, we have the opportunity to find what we in Mesa consider to be a major plan amendment. For most of the city, it has to be a change of at least 320 acres to be considered a major amendment. Now, we do have some special areas within the city where we wanted to keep a little closer look at what happens. One of that is along the Superstition Springs corridor, where we're looking for employment opportunities and business opportunities. And so there we set the standard of any change from non-residential to residential of 20 acres or more would constitute a major plan amendment. Then also in our two airport areas around Falcon Field and Gateway. In those areas, again, because of the airplanes and because of the desire for employment, the standard is any change from non-residential to residential would be considered a major plan amendment. The process requires that all major plan amendments filed in a calendar year must be heard by council at one time during that same calendar year. The process also requires that we go through what's called a 60-day review period, where we send out notice of the final application to surrounding jurisdictions and other institutions, citizens within the community, to give them that 60-day period to review the changes and provide any comments. We also require the Planning and Zoning Board to hold two public hearings and ultimately for council to take action. We anticipate at this point the earliest we would be back to council for your review and decision on these major plan amendments would be October the 21st. Because of that 60-day review process in particular, we believe that there really cannot be any changes to the proposal after we go through that process, because then we'd have to go back through the process again. And so when we get to those final hearings, there's really not much opportunity for modifying or adjusting the proposal. It's really pretty much an up or down kind of vote. So that's why we try to front load the overall process by giving citizens and the council and Planning and Zoning Board the opportunity to see what's been submitted and provide any early feedback, comment, suggestions to the applicants before they make their final proposal. So that's why we're here this morning, to give you a first look at what these two requests are and give you that opportunity to provide us and the applicants any feedback, ask any questions you have about the applications early on. So as stated, we do have two amendments that have been submitted this year. The first one that we'll look at is at the intersection of the 202 and the US 60. They're on the north side of Baseline. Currently, the area is designated a combination of neighborhood commercial and high-density residential 15-plus. They're proposing to reduce the area of the neighborhood commercial and add a little bit more, and add the high-density residential and add some medium-density residential 6 to 10, as shown on these illustrations. Basically, it's about a 54-acre site. Currently, 34 acres are in the neighborhood commercial and 15 or 20 acres in the high-density residential. So it's that reduction of the non-residential, the neighborhood commercial, down to just 5 acres that's making this a major plan amendment. And just a part of the project narrative, they've shown their current anticipation for where they would go with this if they do get the major plan amendment. So this map showed the current zoning on the site and the proposal of what the zoning may be in the future. Quick note here, this looks a little bit odd because you've got what looks like two separate parcels within the overall site. These parcels were created through a court action a few years ago, and there's a piece here that divides kind of these two pieces that are under one ownership from the rest of the property. And this illustrates, again, their early concept of how they may develop the property if the general plan modification is successful. Shows the commercial piece in the south center portion, the single family along the west side, and the multifamily along the east side. So with that, do you have any comments, questions, or feedback that you'd like to give to staff or the applicants at this time?
I remember this came through, what, 3 years ago?
Approximately.
Or longer?
Maybe a longer by now, right.
And I know we were trying to coddle together two different, or four different, I don't know how many different owners were in there, and that's one reason why the plan was a little bit strange. This out, and maybe I was catching up and you explained it. The parcel on that, the northeast part that is already 15-plus, is not included in the amendment, but I'm looking at the land plan here also. Is that still a separate owner and will not be included in the plan now? Is that the...
That's correct, Mayor.
Reason? So we could anticipate that with that, that is already multifamily, basically high density
of that northeast
plan
corner.
Right now.
Correct.
So we could anticipate that that also will probably be developed as multifamily.
That's certainly the current plan.
Okay, so in this plan, I'm assuming then, and I'm asking it obvious, but I want to make sure, that would be included, regardless of what plan came up for the parcels we're looking at right now, the infrastructure, roadway, and everything would be designed and built, assuming that you're going to have those units in that northeast quadrant, right?
Yes, Mayor, unless they came in before this got all the way through the process and proposed something different, absolutely we would take that in consideration.
Well, you'd have to, because you got to assume that if that's the general plan, then that's how it's going to turn out, right?
Yes.
Okay, gotcha. Now, is this with this plan, is the purpose on this one to go through this and to immediately move on to some sort of planning type of a thing?
Yes.
Is this what they've submitted? Is what they're proposing to submit, or is this just illustrative?
Yes, Mayor, it's our understanding that by the time this comes back to you in the fall for action on the major plan amendment, there will be the companion zoning case that will come with it at that time, and something similar to this is what you'll see.
Okay. Gotcha. Once this is in place, though, this is pretty much how it will play out. You know, the configuration may do, you know, the street and the specific layout, but as far as the overall configuration, this is pretty much what we're dealing with then, right?
Yes.
Okay. Questions? Councilmember Summers?
No, Mayor, I had an opportunity to meet with the applicant on this particular property, and there's take it up a little bit more of the 30,000-foot level. There was the original application included in here some office and more retail. But in working with staff, we think that trying to accomplish that office and retail on this particular site is going to be extremely difficult. This site has very poor visibility. For one, you can see the freeway is here. It's elevated at that particular because it's the intersection of two freeways. It only has a half a diamond that is access and egress from the freeway in one direction over here by the neighborhood where it's a baseline road. The next closest to the west also is a half diamond. But there is a full diamond, great access and good visibility to the property that is on the other side of this freeway that you can't see on the picture. So what we had suggested in order to keep our city's vision of jobs in this particular area was to look at transferring some of the job numbers we had hoped to achieve on this property, which would be difficult to achieve, and provide perhaps a density bonus for job creation on that parcel as part of our general plan amendment, so that we would still be able to capture some more jobs. But what we would do is transfer it to another property in the immediate area that had much better access, much better visibility, and so I would support moving forward with that. That said, what I'm going to be looking for from the applicant on this is a very difficult piece of property. I'm going to be looking for the quality of the product they hope to develop, both for multifamily and single family. This particular property, one, will be in a dead end. It has a freeway on both sides, which makes it difficult. So raising the standard here is going to be important. We have talked about using a piece of their commercial part to do some kind of a community facility that would raise the level of interaction amongst the community and, you know, not necessarily a rock wall or swimming pool, but perhaps something of that, you know, a community gathering center. And then the quality of the materials that they use in this facility are going to be important as well. The neighborhood to the west is struggling, but has made many, many strides in bringing their community standard up. It was developed originally in the county. This is one of the communities we've identified for putting in sewer. We added water to some of these communities and new fire hydrants not that long ago, improved water service, and we're looking to add more services there. So they're fighting to bring their community up. They've been successful so far, and I want to make sure that this project helps them raise their community up rather than creates yet another challenge. So there's a lot of challenges to this site. I think the plan, the initial plan that you've that they've presented is a good start, and so I want to see the level of quality is going to be important, so I'm interested in what kind of stipulations they're going to put in there for the builder, because they don't have a builder yet, so it's important that we make sure that we spell those things out so that when they do get a builder, that builder knows exactly what to expect. Thank you, Mayor.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Great.
Okay. Number two.
Number two.
Number two is a 13-acre site on the south side of the 202, west of Val Vista, just north of Thomas Road. The site is currently designated mixed-use residential, and it was part of a larger mixed-use residential area, some of which was changed several years ago to make way for the Lehigh Crossing developed there on the south side of Thomas. Again, the mixed-use residential designation is considered a non-residential classification because its primary emphasis is on the employment and retail uses. The proposal is to change that designation to high-density residential for potential ultimate apartment complex. This just zooms in a little bit to the site so you can see that 15-acre area. The site has a few challenges with the cell tower on the east end and a well site kind of in the middle, and the lack of depth to the property. It's currently zoned.
Having good cell service is a challenge.
That would be a plus.
That sounds like that would be an amenity.
It will be from some perspectives.
And water too.
Right there.
Yeah, I like that. I like that.
Are we talking about public safety communications again?
Order. So as I was saying, the property is currently zoned general industrial, and the plan would be to change it to a high-density residential designation. They have not yet submitted any specific plans or proposals for how the site would develop, but again, it's, the intent would be for that multi-residential.
Is this, I hate to ask this. I'm always confused in this area as to what is that actually in this. I know it's in our planning area, in the city versus, this has been annexed.
Yes.
Okay, because I know at one time it was in our planning area, but it hadn't been annexed, and now it's, so it is actually in the city limits.
Correct. The area just to the south there where the mine is not in the city, but the rest of that is.
Okay. I knew that there was, those parcels were sort of either in or out. It wasn't a whole area, so.
Any other questions about this, comments, feedback for us or the applicant?
Vice Mayor?
Thanks. You know, I was reflecting as I was studying this morning, and as council members, we get a lot of feedback from the community. I can honestly say I've never had anybody come up to me and say, we need more apartment complexes in Mesa. But I have heard a lot of comments to say we need nicer buildings, better quality, whatever's built should look as nice, and they point to other communities sometimes. And so I'm hoping as we see these beautiful pictures on this PowerPoint that we get the quality that they might be indicating here in some way, shape, or form down the road, and just hoping that, you know, you as a planning staff would always, you know, I'm a free market, free enterprise kind of person, but I think there's also we don't need to design their projects, and I know that's been a frustration for Mayor and others as we hear about, but we can sure ask them to build quality projects instead of just taking the profits and running. So anyway, that's my observations for this.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, Vice Mayor. This is a gateway. This is one of the few opportunities we have to provide a gateway in coming off 202 into Val Vista. And if there's one thing I would say that we have not done a great job as a city is really protecting and building up our gateway viewpoints. There's too many ways you get into Mesa that I don't think any of us would run a visitor by and say, gee, isn't this great? We've we've missed a lot of opportunities. I did talk to some the owners of this property, and I echoed what the vice mayor said. I have no problem with residential there, especially there. It seems to work. It's a lot nicer than having a construction yard or something else that could that could play into an industrial type thing, which is about the only thing they can use it for currently. But I said that better be the most stellar multifamily project that we have, because that's what people are going to see, and that needs to be that way. And I don't like to design people's projects, but I don't want junk built. And there's nothing wrong with setting a minimum standard. I think we need to raise our standard and raise it. So I would support this as long as it's made very clear. And I know there's no specific project coming through. They're going to look for a builder or a developer. And there's a lot of good developers out there who build high-quality projects. And I would hope that, that this would be at the top of their list, because it's right along the freeway. And it's right at, once again, an entryway. And a very, very pretty entryway. You know, you have a lot of citrus around there. William Lyon's doing a pretty good job down the road. I've driven through that a few times, and there's nice houses, and it's developing out pretty nice. So this is a nice area.
Yes, it is very visible right there along the freeway, and we can then work with the applicant to make sure we've got some pretty clear design guidelines as part of the general plan amendment about what we're looking for in terms of that quality.
Okay, and it's got great cell service, too. Councilmember Summers.
It's cell service, again, we're on the – never mind. No, I think there's – looking at these two projects, they're a little bit different. I think that we're going to see on the second one, we could take a lighter hand because of the quality that's already in that neighborhood, because of the views and the vistas. And you, granted, there's a freeway there that's a problem, but that's really the only problem. So I think we're going to be able to get a high-quality project in this area a lot easier. The other site, however, has far more impediments to that, so I would pay a lot of attention to that one to make sure that we set that minimum standard the mayor is talking about to ensure we get a good quality project on the two. But I agree with the rest of the comments Mayor made.
Okay. All right.
Unless there's anything else, that's it. Appreciate
that's
your comments.
It. Thank you. It was easy. Next item is to hear presentation, discuss, provide direction on the following department budgets. Mr. Brady, you want to go in the order that this is listed? Okay, police.
Good morning, Mayor, Vice Mayor, Council.
We have a number of slides to show you, reference our proposed budget for 13-14. I have with me Chris York, who is our Director of Finance, takes care of all of our fiscal management, and Assistant Chief Mario Latanzio will be assisting. First, I want to just talk about our crimes and arrests. If you look at the graphs in front of you, you can see very vividly that as our number of arrests go up, our crimes are going down, and our Part 1 crimes are continuing to move in a downward trend over the last 3 years. This year, so far, we're down about 5.9%. The emphasis that we've been using out in patrol is really to take care of street-level drug arrests, gang arrests, and really get the officers engaged in that street-level activity, because I think the results are proven that that's what's driving crime. Drugs continue to drive property crime, identity theft, vehicle thefts, and others in the city. So I have to give the men and women of the police department an incredible amount of credit for their tenacity and for really, even with the lean staffing model that we continue to work with, they're out giving 100% to the citizens day in and day out. Our crimes for population, we're down to lows back almost 60 years. Again, I think that's just by the increased efforts and the fact that we're out going after the right people, recidivists, career criminals. And we've done several covert operations that have netted a large number of arrests that are the right people. And again, I think that's driving down our rates. If you look at the, move to the next slide, one more, yeah, that one, there you go. You can see that overall we're down in count and we're down in percentage in all areas of crimes, violent crimes, property crimes. Our arrests are up, and drug arrests continue to move. So the efforts are paying off. Innovations with impact for 2012-13. Our career criminal squad, we use money from last year's budget to build this offender reintegration and enforcement squad. Their job, again, was to go after career criminals, to work with the Department of Corrections, and try to get those people that are being put back in our community off to a good start so they don't become recidivists, and we have to deal with that issue. We had our seized vehicle project. We did the pilot, and the idea was to, as we seize vehicles, is to take those into a pool or to take the ones that we're able to use and put them into service. And the ones that we took into the pool, we would sell and then take the, you know, through auction, and we would take those proceeds to purchase usable vehicles for our undercover operations, trying to take a load off the budget and use the criminals' money to fund some of the transportation issues that we are having in the department. We deployed on a test program last year 30 electronic ticket machines. That we gave those to the traffic officers and some others to use. They cut down the time for citations. They're more accurate. They've actually caused the courts to show a decrease in their staffing hours required to process those citations, because normally they'd have to be transcribed and from a hard copy to a machine. This takes care of all that, and it's helped with their staffing levels. We're expanding that program with the assistance of the court and the city manager's office to a number of 70 over the next fiscal year. The career criminal and apprehension squad, we staffed it with a sergeant and six SWAT officers, so it wasn't any new positions. We were able to take from existing places, still have the availability of our SWAT resource, but to actually use that career criminal squad to again go after those hardcore street level criminals that we need to get off the street. The mission includes contact with violent and repeat offenders, accomplished through collaboration with adult probation, federal agencies, community service groups, and other Mesa PD units. Assistant Chief Meza continues to be our outside liaison. He's a member of several boards, but he works very closely with New Leaf and Community Bridges and make sure that we know what they're doing so our programs correspond to what's going on in those programs outside of the department. The career criminal squad in 2013, they made 79 arrests, 17 were proactive, and they were targeted arrests, or not targeted arrests, excuse me. That they were arrested for a variety of new charges, including homicide, robbery, murder for hire, conspiracy, aggravated assault, child pornography, burglary, witness tampering, and firearm trafficking and drugs. Again, when we're doing these covert operations, we're able to get to know who the people are in the neighborhood that are causing the problems, and through those relationships, we're able to solve other crimes with that covert knowledge. Further, with the seized vehicle program, we had $62,000, almost $63,000 was earmarked for the purpose of the RICO account. We talked about them not part of the fleet. We are in the process of purchasing three newer vehicles with that money. I want to talk a little bit about what we're doing internally, because you'll see a little bit of a theme here where our efficiency is being driven by our electronic innovations, and that's what we continue to work with. Mario?
Currently, our policies are in the Word, and they're on a drive. We recently purchased a program called Power DMS, which is an electronic document management system. It's web-based. It allows us to import those documents into Power DMS. What it does for the field officer who's been out in the field, he can log into Power DMS. It'll track what policies is reviewed. We can put training bulletins in there. We can also have tests in there, those types of things. So that'll help us better keep our policies up to date and actually track what kind of training we're doing out in the field. It also allows us with our CLIA accreditation process. CLIA stands for the Commission on Accreditation for Law Enforcement Agencies. We're currently 1 year into the program. We used to be a CLIA accredited several years ago. Now we're going back into that process again. We have 2 more years to become accredited. What this program does with Power DMS, before we used to keep books with proofs of compliance, so you would have binders and binders trying to show how we were compliant with the CLIA standards. This allows us to do everything electronically. We can post all the proofs of compliance inside the program. The program is also, we can transmit it to CLIA where they can review the proofs of compliance up front before they even come out and do an on-site inspection. We're also using that for our lab. The lab is also accredited through the American Society of Crime Laboratory Directors and Laboratory Accreditation Board called ASCLAD. Currently, it's certified under the legacy program. The new accreditation process is called ISO 17025. All labs are required to be accredited by 2015. Our current goal is by be accredited by 2014. Currently, right now, all our policies are already in Power DMS for the lab. It was the first one that we were able to get done, and now we're working through the accreditation process.
How much money do you owe us for all the acronyms, seriously?
You know, I think that's the only way they know how
that's to. That's why I try to explain them all.
It's the you got to have your own language.
It's the science of acronyms, sir.
I'm sure they're done in the fire department. So.
Innovations with Impact Continuing. We partnered, we actually were contacted by the International Association of Chiefs of Police back in 2012, and they wanted to do a pilot project, and they picked 3 cities in the nation, and Mesa was one of them. That pilot project was to work closely on a geographically based prosecution model where we met with County Attorney Bill Montgomery, who was more than helpful. And actually, since we've completed this project that I'm going to tell you about here, he's actually reorganized his entire attorney's office based on geographic prosecution. What he realized is that when you have the same prosecutor that's out there working with you in those crime areas, they actually see, and they don't just read it on the paper, what's happening and what the problems are, that everyone is more involved and engaged, and it helps tell the story better. I think it's analogous to reading a book about the Grand Canyon or standing on the side of the Grand Canyon. The book's great and it gets you there, but until you actually stand with the officers out in the area or stand on the edge of the canyon, you don't realize the magnitude of what's going on. And in this particular area in Mesa, what they call D Block, the Duran and now I'm losing the other street.
Allen.
And Allen, the little 3 or 4 block area, we were having hundreds of calls there every year, to the tune of about 400 calls a year, so more than one a day. Over the year period that they did the program, they partnered with the community, with the outreach, with the faith groups. We used adult probation. We actually used probationers to go out and clean up the area. They removed 31 tons of trash from the area. They had community events at local churches. They did job training. They were able to get 8 youths out of the area actual full-time jobs and get them employed. And this collaboration of all these city services and state services was able to make an incredible difference. The park there is now cleaned up and it's safe for people to attend. We have started 3 other programs, and I think there's one almost in each or straddles council districts with Operation Mainline, with the Rotary Park program, and one more. Rotary Park, Mainline. I'll think of the other in a minute, but we have one more going on as well, so it's been very helpful. The other thing that we've been driving out of Mesa and is the sharing of information. I think a lot of people believed that it was like watching 24 or any other of these cop shows where if you needed information, you know, we could get to cameras and we could get the information anywhere in the nation, and that wasn't true. With the help of Bill Califf, who we hired from the Arizona Criminal Justice Commission to come over and help us with our technology, the Mesa node of CopLink, and CopLink is basically a Google search engine for police officers. You have a license plate, you have a name, you have a description. You can put this bit of information into a search engine, and it will query all of the reports from all the other agencies that are hooked up, and one of those nodes in Arizona belongs to Mesa. As a proof of concept, we connected to the United States Capital Region to show that you could take disparate systems and connect them if those two systems were willing to do so. And one's owned by IBM and the other one's owned by Northrop Grumman. And through our work with those two players, we were able to get them to do a proof of concept and show that it worked. And then we showed it again when we hooked up to all of the regions in the Rio Grande area in New Mexico. Since then, we've connected with L.A. County, L.A. City. We just did a connection with Las Vegas. We have a connection with everything that goes on out of the COPLINK node in Colorado. So we have almost all of Southern California and the West covered. We are actually one of the smaller nodes originally, but our officers are using that system. And I'll give you an example. We have 782 sworn positions in Mesa. Phoenix PD still has roughly 3,000. Mesa officers hit Phoenix's node more than Phoenix hits their node and gets information. So they're using it to solve crimes every day. So our lead in information sharing goes all the way back to the Capital Region, and we're back from Major City Chiefs Conference. It's Mesa that's leading the way in information sharing, and that work continues to benefit our investigations back to the Fusion Center. And we actually do work for the Arizona Counterterrorism Information Center, the ACTIC, which is supposed to be the big brother of all the Fusion Centers. They're actually calling us for help. So we continue to supply information to them. It's been a great asset to the department and the officers. And that information is actually available in their mobile terminals in their cars.
Another thing we're doing is with the Fusion Center is we're putting what we call, it's a program called Analyst Notebook, and what that's going to allow us to do as we talk about COPLINK and all these different information sites that come in, we don't have a robust way to analyze all that information. Currently, you have to do it manually because it comes in from all these different nodes based on the searches. Well, what Analyst Notebook does is it's a relationship builder. So when you look at the graph that we have up there, or the picture, it kind of shows it takes all that information from all those different points, analyzes it, and then it produces one product for you. So that's something we're looking to do over the next year. It's not there yet. We're looking to deploy that, and it will also, with a new upgrade to it, come with the case management system that we can use also. This device here, we're looking to work with Morpho next year. What this device does, it's a latent print identification system at the scene. Now, when you take prints, you process the prints, and they have to go to the lab, and it probably could be, depending on the how fast you need it back, it may take a week or it may take a couple of weeks to get that information back to find out who that print belongs to. Now, you can take this device out the scene. After they process it, you can run it through the device. It'll go through the state APHIS database system and let you know if there's a match. So right there, the officer can get the information now, it's fresh, and they can act on it.
We actually also deployed 8 of these mobile units just yesterday. We were putting them in cars, so these will be out in the field, and they can do this two-finger fast ID on suspects. Again, it's just efficiency through technology.
Good morning. Another innovation that we have is we're looking to convert 5 of our sworn positions that are currently held by sworn staff into civilian positions. Mm-hmm. What that's going to enable us to do is to put these officers in on the street where they're needed and to patrol, and then basically continue to fund the current positions at a civilian level at a reduced cost. So it'll be savings for the.
And that's kind of been the model that I've been working with city manager's office is try and identify as many places where we can civilianize positions in the department and then take those sworn people doing those jobs and get them out to enforcement capacity type jobs. And over the last 2 budget cycles, I think we've done that about with 15 positions. And as money becomes available, we'll identify more people to move out and do things. Again, our patrol staffing has been a challenge for us. This year in our bid for patrol, there will be 325-ish positions in the bid for uniform patrol, and that will be the highest that we've had over the last 3 years. So it will be more people in patrol than we've had since I've arrived.
Just on the legal advisor makes sense to me. I'm just curious about the sworn hiring coordinators. Are you still going to have sworn members assisting in recruitment? Is that,
yes,
you know,
absolutely.
It would seem to me that if you're going to try to recruit somebody, now it's probably easier than it, because the economy's still a little bit slow, but as things start to pick up, it becomes increasingly difficult to recruit the right type of candidates into law enforcement. I remember these conversations from 5 years ago. If you put a non-sworn member out there to talk about why they should become police officers, it would seem the first question you ask, well, how do you know? You've
right.
never been one. So are you looking to use past sworn members? Are you going to be having sworn members with the non-sworn members? I mean, you want to have that experience so that they can talk to potential recruits about what the work is truly like, not the dramatized version of it.
No, that's a great question, Councilmember Summers. And just to clarify that, these are primarily the background investigators who do the paperwork that's involved and doing all the background checks. We still have a sworn lieutenant and a sworn sergeant in there, and then we still have recruiters that come from different walks of the department, from the academy, from hiring, and this isn't all of the staffing that's in hiring, but these are mainly the administrative functions. And one of the ideas to staff this, again, because of what you said, is to find retired officers or people that want to come in that have a background in training and can get through our process to do that for
okay,
us.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
What we have here is a financial overview of the current adopted budget as compared to the proposed budget for 2013-14. What you'll notice primarily is in personal services, you'll see an increase from 12-13 to 13-14. That primarily is due to the increase in just staff costs. The pension costs have gone up. Our public safety, our Arizona State retirement costs have gone up. Additionally, you'll see where we have the half-time pay for this next fiscal year budgeted in there. Another item to note is, what to take note of is that in the 12-13 adopted budget, that includes any items that have been rebudgeted, and so we're in the process right now of doing those, and so that's why the number's a little bit lower at 13-14, because we still have those figures to calculate and get into the budget. And so the top half we have broken down by type of expenditure, and the bottom half is from the fund types.
So, Mayor and Council, you can still see the quality of life dollars are still going to contribute towards the support of the police department. So that's what the bottom part is beginning to kind of break out and show you where the sources of funding are coming from, whether it's grants, quality of life, and general fund. So that's what that purpose of that kind of bottom half of that chart is for.
And you'll notice on the grants, the part of the reduction in the grants is from the COPS hiring grant, which is set to expire in August.
And doesn't that explain the general fund number going up a little bit in personal services? Would that be considered part of
that? Personal services includes all fund types, so that would include that at the top, but it would include the general fund.
That's the expenditure.
Below the general fund.
Absolutely.
Absolutely,
yes.
But I'm as a percentage of overall budget, your personnel costs have gone up over 4% from about 79% to 83% of your budget.
Yes.
That's driving by those non-controllable costs. When I say non-controllable, pension, we
semi-control
health benefits.
Yeah.
So that's the frustrating thing, and this is just the world we live in, is that we're not adding officers, we're adding costs onto the existing labor pool is basically what's happening. Is that
yeah, I mean, the cost, accurate? You know, if you go back, just the way the world is, it's not anything that the department's done. If you go look at the cost per officer, what it was 5 years ago today, I can't remember what the number is, $10,000, $12,000 more.
It was approximately 33%, I believe, of a $50,000 salary back in.
Yeah. So it's just that growing cost.
And it's not
that's included, 60%. And that makes it a challenge because, you know, if we had opportunity, we'd like to bring obviously more officers on, more patrol officers on, but our cost per unit continues to grow, even during the time when our revenues were decreasing. So,
like I said, those are costs imposed by others. That's why I call them non-controllable.
Right.
We can't totally control the pension costs because we get a bill from the state every year. So, Councilman Richens,
Do you have a Academy class budgeted in this fiscal year?
Yes, we will do a class, and again, it's just attrition positions. We'll do a class that starts in early July. We'll graduate October-ish, November. Right now, with attrition, it looks like it'll have about 20 MESA recruits, and out of that 20, we'll probably graduate 14 or 15. And then we're still doing lateral hiring. And just to talk about laterals for a minute, they save me a ton of money if we get the right people. And that's the issue. You always got to make sure that the laterals are coming in are the cream of the crop and they're not somebody running from an issue or a problem somewhere else. We've hired about 12 or 13 laterals over the last year, and we've had no issues. We have five in the pool right now to be hired, an additional five we're looking at, and I have approval to hire another five on top of that if we can find them for a number of 15. They save me about $100,000 a person in training costs. And they also hit the street with experience, and that value is value added to the other officers on the street.
Vice Mayor?
Thanks. I really appreciate you bringing up that part. That was one of the things I wanted to, that lateral program, looking at the civilian portion. These are all great moves. I think a lot of us have talked about it for years, and I really appreciate you doing that. But wanted to just make an observation as you and express appreciation from your earlier slides of talking about how you're policing in the community. I had a chance yesterday to go out to it's called Operation Mainline.
Yes, sir.
It's targeting an area on Main Street between Higley Road and Power, and from University to Broadway. There's been an increase in criminal activity in that area. And so through Commander Cantrell, they have met with the business owners, residents out there, and actually brought them to a command van site, brought in and did the complete briefing, and we had adult probation and parole. We had the prosecutors from the Maricopa County office and from the city, and it was an amazing coordinated effort to go out and get those individuals, a lot of it drug-related, that are causing a lot of the problems in the area. It was so well received by the citizens. It's a smart way to do business. Everybody could look at that and go, this is amazing what they're doing, and I think it contributes to those really low crime stats. And so hats off to all those individuals, the officers out there that are risking their lives, from police administration and looking a way to do these things. I can't say enough positives. Very impressed with how you're handling that. So thank you.
Thank you for recognizing their efforts, sir.
Thank you. Councilmember Summers?
Yeah. First, it's a tough business that you're in because it's a service industry. So it doesn't surprise me that personnel services is such a big part of your budget. It's about police officers, about putting police officers on the street fighting crime. And they're, while you're integrating an amazing amount of technology and innovating at every turn and trying to make it as easy as you can and effective and increase the effectiveness of each and every officer that you have, the fact of the matter is it requires people in the car, boots on the ground, and somebody ready to put the handcuffs on the bad guy and throw him in jail. That's the business that you're in. And so, keeping those costs down are difficult. And certainly what we're trying to do is control healthcare costs are a huge concern, particularly for officers. And I think what Mr. Brady and others have done, and your officers and Ryan Russell and some others working together with labor have done to try to control those costs are admirable, and it's going to be a continuous ongoing effort in order to do that. I do have a specific question on grants. You had noted that a lot of this innovation that you're purchasing, you had noted the operation of the that you have here and how important it is to the region. But I suspect that some of the grant dollars that we are receiving is a critical component to the operation of those facilities and the innovations that we're able to do, because this crime fighting is truly a federal, state, and local partnership. Local law enforcement plays a huge role in homeland security. When you look at stuff that happened in Boston, I think it and the investigation going on and the collaboration that's happening, it just illustrates how important it is and to prevent that kind of thing. So would you discuss very briefly where we are on the grants, what we could expect over the next year or two with those grants, and how that might impact your operation in some of these facilities.
Let me just start, and then I'll let Krista comment on a little bit more specificity. But the federal grants, as you well know, sir, are continuing to dwindle. UWASI, the Urban Area Security Initiative grants, those continue to decrease. The State Homeland Security Grant Program, the SHSCIP program, continues to decrease. So some of those things we do for Homeland Security, for site hardening, those continue to be hard to come by. Going back 5 or 6 years in my career, even back at Phoenix, we continued to meet with Secretary Napolitano and others back in D.C. trying to get Arizona moved up on the priority list for those type of grant funding. And at the time, one of our arguments was that Philadelphia was a tier one city and we weren't, and the populations were very similar. And so we fought with that, but haven't had a lot of luck in the past. We just were given information 2 days ago from the COPS office for hiring. They're actually doing another match of three quarters of an officer's salary for 3 years. I gave that to my current boss to look at and then see if there's an option down the road for us to apply for some of those positions. I'm just saying there's an opportunity that exists, and we never know what happens. But the technology grants, the ones that drive the laboratory, they've been coming through. We have an incredible relationship with Arizona Governor's Office of Highway Safety. They continue to fund a lot of our traffic programs. Those things continue to happen. So there are funding out there, but specifically anything that's dropping by percentages, I would have to ask Krista.
We are losing on the Homeland Security grants. We are seeing a decrease in those. Overall, there is that tightening of the belt at the federal level. We are very dependent on those for a lot of our technology-related grants because those are such high-dollar purchases and acquisitions for us. Where we're seeing that they're still putting money out is for a lot of the high-crime type of. You know, they have different ideas they're targeting, and we've had the Marshal's Office. We get reallocation of funds. They always come back with additional funding. The one good thing with the City of Mesa, I have to say, is that a lot of the federal grantors like working with us, and so when they do have additional funds available, they do contact us and let us know that they have additional funding, whether it's to buy a new command van or a DUI van, and so we are getting a lot of reallocation of funds that aren't being used by other agencies.
Are we going to be able to sustain our efforts, particularly with the Fusion Center, if these grants dry up?
Fusion Center is not really impacted. That's a collaborative effort by all the agencies involved. Right now, the money that we all put a person in there, in fact, Mesa has a couple, the money that runs the operation day-to-day is from all the cities involved. I think right now everyone's required to put in about $10,000 a year. It's not a lot of money, including, and plus they pay for an FTE.
Are we paying for the TLO, or does the federal government provide some of that?
The TLO is just Chris Domchek's whole terrorism liaison officer. The funding for the terrorism liaison officer is comes
Thank
out of our budget.
Chief.
You're welcome, sir.
Yeah, don't worry about these people. Anyway.
I'm just trying to sound smart anyway.
We additionally,
or should I say, instead of saying chief, should I say FTE? Thank you, FTE. Chief FTE. We appreciate that.
LEO.
I just thought it sounded sexy, sir, so I used
it. All right, with that, I'm
We do have additional funding from the Attorney General's office on settlement awards, and that is helping to fund the Fusion Center as well. And so this was a case that was adjudicated, and we were awarded those funds, and so that money has been carried over, rebudgeted from year to year, and that is a big funding source to purchase some of these larger dollar non-operating type items.
And just one more thing on the Fusion Center, because I think it's notable for everyone, is we met yesterday. We had a Fusion Center meeting, and all the chiefs have in principle agreed starting next year to add an additional body to the Fusion Center. So we're going to build it out a little further, add more workspace, And I think every city will end up having two people in there instead of the single person, try to increase staffing hours and cover more of the day. And our efforts really is to go to what we refer to as a real-time crime center. And the idea is that as calls are dispatched, there's people inside, detectives, officers, analysts, that can start getting information on the call, who's there, address, premise history, and really start solving what's going on and giving the officer as much information before they arrive at the call for officer safety issues, for efficiency issues. And that is kind of the goal that we'll be trying to get to over probably the next 36 months is that real-time crime center.
Yeah, I want to continue to be an advocate for that operation because the Fusion Centers was a victim of a very bad study that was methodologically flawed, I think more likely ideologically slanted. And the fact is that the Fusion Centers are key for preventing incidents like what happened in Boston, and so anything that we could do to help to make sure that that operation continues to receive the funding and attention that it deserves, because I truly believe it is partially responsible for why our crime rate in Mesa is down below 1960s level, and it's done a tremendous job. It's a huge asset.
Thank you for your commitment, sir.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thanks. You guys do a great job. And point out these numbers. It seems like when most of us came into office here, we were at a 70-70 rule, and that varied by 3 or 4%. 70% of a city's budget was basically in public safety, and then 70 to 75% was in personnel costs. And I think what we've seen over the last 5 years is a drastic change in those percentages. And as I talk to mayors from around the country, this is happening in every city. It's not us. It's just the nature of what we have. So where now cities are now pushing 80% of their overall budget is public safety, 80-plus percent in some cases, and personnel costs, as we've seen right now, are now above 80%, and I think 5 years ago they were probably around that 70% range. So, as a proportion of our overall budget and as a proportion of public safety is taking up a larger proportion of our overall budget, general fund-wise, and within public safety, personnel costs, because primarily pension, health, those kind of things, because we certainly haven't been doling out huge raises to people because of the budgetary constraints, but just what in many ways are costs that we don't totally control have been eating up a much larger percentage. And I don't say that to complain, but that's a challenge that we have, because this is, as Councilmember Summers said, it's a people business. We beat crime because we have people in fusion centers and on the street, and we have highly trained people doing very important tasks, and that is becoming more and more costly as a relative number to our other budgets. So, the fact that you've been able to accomplish what you've accomplished and deal with these budgetary constraints is a real kudo for you. But I don't see that getting any better in this year and the coming years. I think it's a challenge we're going to consistently have to deal with, because I haven't gotten any memos lately that says pension costs are going to reverse themselves or health costs are going down. If anything, there's going to be pressure on both those to go up, and unfortunately that doesn't add additional people to the streets. So we'll do our best to figure out what we can do, and at the same time, as you said, less and less money is coming from the state and Washington, and the only reason I bring that up is not that we depend upon that, but these are shared responsibilities. And I think one of the things that we're pushing for is we don't look for handouts, but we do look for partners. And we think that if we're going to share in the responsibility of overall homeland security and things like that, that our partners, the people for whom we're doing this work, and in many cases it's the federal government who has the primary responsibility for frontline homeland security, we're bearing, the whole scheme of things is that local governments bear a very large percentage of the burden for those efforts. Am I wrong in that? I mean, in our scheme, it's a shared responsibility. And what concerns me is that in Washington, the view is to pull back and leave us holding the bag with the responsibility, and yet Washington is not sharing in their responsibility, which is primarily, hey, we've asked you to do this. We're not adding any officers. And whether it be immigration enforcement or terrorism or all those things, we're getting less and less out of our partners, and that's troublesome. So I applaud you for, in that environment, doing what you're doing and succeeding. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And, you know, one of the credit also has to go to this community, because where we're short on officers, when they see something, they say something, and our community does call us. They do trust the men and women on the street, and I think we're responsive to them. So that is a huge asset to this particular city, is the community involvement.
See something, say something. That's got a ring to it. We may want to use something like that.
We're going to put it on shirts, maybe.
Why don't we do that?
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate it. Ariel, Chris, thank you. Next item is development and sustainability.
Morning, Council Mayor. My name is Christine Zalanka. I'm the Development and Sustainability Department Director. I have Carol Haddad with me here today, who's going to drive. She's our management assistant. I also have the rest of the team back here in case there are questions that I can't answer. They'll help. Just to remind you what our department does, we have planning led by John Wesley, development services, and which serves really as a central point of contact for developers coming into the city. We have building inspections, we've code compliance and environmental and sustainability. So we have a very eclectic blend of different work groups. The goal really across the city is to improve the quality of the built environment, both existing development, redevelopment, and new development. What I wanted to do today was talk about a couple of the major innovations that we're looking towards in the future, and then also a few of the programs that you actually asked us to look into last year. The most important issue that we are really trying to work on is improving our technology. We currently have about a 10-year-old outdated technology application. It's called Tidemark. We're actually coining a new acronym going forward. It's the Development Information Management Enterprise System. What we are going to do this year is go out for a request for proposal to try to get the latest technology that will allow electronic plan review. Our development community is begging us to do that. Most all development these days, most all the plans are developed electronically. Then they have to print them out at a very large cost, bring them down to the city. Through a more effective technology, we could increase staff productivity, actually increase productivity and the customer service and the development community.
What would how complex? It seems like that would be a fairly simple fix. Am I underestimating the complexity of that?
Yeah, I think you are, sir.
Oh, thank you. That's okay. Because if I am, I don't want to be wrong. Tell me what's involved in that.
Yeah, we have over 200 users across the city, different departments that use our permitting system. Everything from water resources, engineering, transportation, certainly code compliance, business services. And what we're looking at, because the technology is so old, I mean, you can imagine 10-year-old technology is pretty well outdated. And we really think we need to upgrade the entire system. It's currently very inflexible. If we have somebody that would like a new report, do something new with it, it's very difficult to maneuver it.
I understand the challenge. I guess what I'm getting at, it would seem like that nationwide that this is developed into where there should be some off-the-shelf kind of a
software we're absolutely looking
that you could
for
implement. At that point in time, it's database-driven.
Tidemark is that.
Okay. I guess that's what I'm getting at. I get the process, but it would seem like the fix should be almost plug-and-play kind of a stuff.
We will go out and purchase.
Okay.
Yes.
I would hope that we don't have to do any...
Typically, the most challenging thing with some... Because it's so data-intensive, is just converting the current data into the new system so it can pull it up. That's really that's one of the biggest challenges we have.
Yeah, what we would like to do is go to a web-based system.
Okay.
One of the biggest issues is close to real-time access. So when our plans examiners are reviewing plans, an engineer could be sitting in New Jersey getting those real-time corrections. We're hoping to get interactive monitors where when we're doing plan review, somebody sitting across the country, across the world, quite frankly, could see what our plans examiners are doing, make those corrections, pick up the phone, say, you know, I don't understand, what are you doing on that area? And we could increase the turnaround time or decrease the turnaround time, eliminate the need for customers to actually have to bring huge rolls down.
Like I said, my guess is that those systems exist as a package that we would not have to develop internally.
We're not having to create a lot of new programming. Right.
No, it's just going out and looking for the best off-the-shelf project. Yes. So the goal on
that
is...
I mean, I know we're a little bit behind in this, not horribly, but I know there are other cities, and maybe they're having to upgrade, too, that have done this for at least a couple, 3 years. So it seems, and the reason I say that is it seems like we have somebody's blazed the trail. We have people out there who have tested systems, who have figured out what works, what doesn't work.
And we're doing that. Peoria recently, within the last couple of years, upgraded to a web-based program. Maricopa County is already using it, which is kind of sad. There's a number of other cities across the country that have upgraded. And that's one of the things that ITD is helping us with, is to reach out to those communities, really try to find out what worked, what didn't work, and what meets our needs.
All right.
One of the biggest problems associated with our current technology and what happened to the economy is scanning. We've talked to you about this last year. We've continued to keep the scanning program going, decreasing hard copy file space. We've done that primarily through temporary employees, interns, pretty much anybody that we can kind of scrape up. It's been a sputter and start. We don't have full-time people that are doing it. But the challenge really of showing up here, because we had to stop the scanning program when the economy hit, we just didn't have the money to continue that. We are being overrun by paper. The new DIMES effort will allow electronic plan review. We'll get rid of the paper problem and the cost and, quite frankly, the amount of space that it takes up that's underutilized. So we are going to try to continue that program this next year. It's actually quite a long-term project. Over the last year, we've scanned in almost 11,000 documents, planning documents. We're estimating it's going to take about 24 months to continue that project. Once we get through all the planning cases, then we'll move on to the building plans and also the microfiche. We have about 1.3 million microfiche files that have to be reviewed and then gotten into an electronic basis. This is really when developers come in or an issue comes up with a change of occupancy, needing to go back and find out, okay, what was that building? What was there originally? And again, the DIMES project will prevent that problem long term, but it's a several year implementation. A couple of the projects that I know you're aware of that I wanted to highlight that we started this year that are moving into next year, our general plan update that John Wesley and Tom Ellsworth are leading. One of the major things that we've done over the last couple of years, rather than going out and hiring consultants to do these major planning efforts, we've actually used in-house staff. It's been a tremendous learning opportunity for our own staff. We have a website set up. John and his group have been going out to virtually any public meeting that is out there, utilizing both hard copy and the web-based application. They've been to, I think, all of the IMESA meetings now. As of last week, they've gone to Pancake Breakfast, Building Strong Neighborhoods, Celebrate Mesa. So we're really out there trying to get the public's input as to what they would like to see the community be. We also have interest groups that they've been to, the Chamber of Commerce, West Mesa CDC, Council Advisory Boards, et cetera. So our plan is to continue that update of the general plan. It'll come back to you for review in 13-14, and then it will actually have to go to the voters for final approval in 2014. But our goal is to complete that project this next year. One of the more fascinating things that we're doing is the sign code update. As you may recall, when we did the zoning code, we did not deal with signage just because that's such a complex issue by itself. Gordon Sheffield is taking the lead on that. He's got a stakeholder group together, actually working with the sign companies. There's always a lot of controversy about signage. He's being very methodical about doing that, trying to weigh the needs of the community, the commercial and residential folks, with the visual quality of the city. So again, we anticipate that that will be coming to you this next year for your initial thoughts on that. We continue to manage our day-to-day workload with temporary workers and interns when we can get them. It's a great way to have sort of younger folks come through and help mentor them, bring them up, and it allows us to be very adaptable to workload fluctuations. One of the other programs that you asked us to look into last year was reintroducing an over-the-counter plan review process. The focus last year was really on the mom-and-pop individual residential. We actually brought a temp worker on site. That program was implemented in November of 2012. It's been very well received. To date, we've had 87 over-the-counter permits issued, 182 owner consultations have been completed, and 199 other types of plans reviewed. What we'd like to do over the next year is actually expand that pilot program to cover simple sign reviews, also simple commercial reviews. If something comes in, it's just tenant improvements, relatively simple commercial, that we could also do that over the counter. I would like to get us to the point where minor corrections on second and third reviews, even for larger plans, could come in more over the counter. They wouldn't have to get into the queue for an 18-day turnaround, get the small stuff out of the system so our more senior plans reviewers can concentrate on the larger projects, hopefully even to get the turnaround times turned to reduce there. Those programs, both residential and then the additional commercial, will be based on customer demand and revenues coming in with those specific programs. I know we've had a lot of discussion about where the economy is. We put together here just a real quick snapshot. This is our total permit revenues for both residential and commercial going back to 2007. You can see the cliff that happened in 2008, where we were in 9 and 10. And this is our third year of starting to climb up out of that. Last year, we saw a pretty significant increase. We continue to see increase in activity. And we've actually been reaching out to the major home builders, the home builders associations, to try to get projections on where they think they're going next year. We've got a number of very large developments that we know are going to take off. So our expectation is both on residential and commercial. It's going to continue to hold strong through the next year, absent any catastrophic worldwide economic problems. Budgeted revenues for 12-13 in development services, we had $4 million approximately in planning, $500,000. Year-end projections based on February actuals and then basically straight-lining projections through the end of the year. In development services, just over $6 million in revenues and just over $900,000 in planning. And again, that's primarily based on actuals through February. Projected revenues for 13-14, and again, kind of trying to spruce up our crystal ball on where the economy is going, but based on everything we're hearing, planning revenues should be up a little over $1 million, and development services about $6.8 million. Those are relatively conservative estimates, but trying to be realistic on the level of activity that we've actually seen. One of the other things I wanted to highlight as far as accomplishments this last year was our Central Main Street plan. We talked a lot to you about that. We actually got the prestigious Criscordia Environmental Excellence Award from Valley Forward. I wanted to remind everybody about that. That was a very collaborative effort between a lot of the city departments. We're going to move through that one pretty quickly. Okay.
See, Chris and Dina kind of.
No, that was a great event. And one of the other things I wanted to highlight there is John really, he used his own staff to do that. Jeff McVeigh took the lead on that. And again, rather than spending probably 2 to 3 times as much money to go out and hire a consultant, we really felt like we had the expertise in-house. We know the community. And just with a little bit of outside help, really and with a tremendous amount of help from our stakeholders who stuck with us for, 18 months. Really,
I'm glad to know the stakeholders stuck with you because that's what stake
did. And I was actually the cookie lady that brought bringing them cookies at night seemed to help. Wanted to switch to code compliance. One of our major goals is voluntary compliance, to really get the community cleaned up by educational efforts rather than a strong focus on enforcement, although taking enforcement actions when we have to. Currently, we're at about 85% voluntary compliance, which I really think is a tremendous acknowledgement of the good work that Laura Heineman and her staff does. One of our continuing challenges, is, as you well know, over the last several years, is we have 7 officers, and the average open cases that we have per officer per month is 171, which is a lot of open cases per code officer. They work very hard, but that's a big number for a limited number of staff. Yes, sir.
Well, just along those lines, I didn't know if you were moving on to the next area, but, you know, council's one of their big goals this year and hopefully in the future is how to support neighborhoods. And so I've had an opportunity to meet with Code Compliance and Ms. Heineman and trying to look at ideas, funding to take down, burned out structures, things like that, and just trying to figure out a different way to do this. So any suggestions? And I'm just hoping that we have an opportunity to maybe put some emphasis here. I don't know how all these budget presentations will go, but this is a what I would say is what council said is a big emphasis about supporting those neighborhoods. And so
couple of ideas and some innovations that we've implemented. We do now have an online complaint form where someone can submit a complaint through the website. Laura just recently caused the mobile application to go live. So transportation has been using this for a while. So if you've got a smartphone, I actually tried it. It works really well. What I took a picture of wasn't actually a violation, but I was just playing. but you can take your smartphone, either, whichever brand you have. Take pictures. If you've got the GPS on, it'll tell exactly the address. I actually took a picture of the council chambers. And it actually gave...
code violation. The nuisance.
It was on a windy day. What ends up happening with our admin person in code, she got the violation, it showed the address, the picture of what the violation was, and then the individual can mark what the problem was that they thought. One of our enhancements that I've chatted with Laura about is to see if we can get more text in that My Mesa app. So, if somebody sees 6-inch weeds on their neighbor's lawn, well, that's probably not yet a violation. So we don't want to have that app, just bringing in a lot of cases that aren't really violations. So it's out there now. We've actually gotten a number of responses on it, and we'll continue to try to increase the effectiveness of that.
Okay. And you have a plan for making sure we stay out of neighborhood spats, neighbor spats? I hate for this to turn, and you've dealt with this in the traditional model too, just now that we're switching over to a technology, makes it even easier for them just to keep taking pictures of their neighbor's yard that they don't like. And just because they don't like a tree doesn't, I'd take a picture of my neighbor's tree that keeps dropping its leaves in my pool, but I would hope you would not respond to that.
We'll continue to be objective. I think that's the role the city plays. It's trying to be a mediator between the two neighbors and what are the rules and what.
My response was to put up another tree that drops leaves in his pool. So we're good. We're good.
The fourth bullet point talks about the use of a temporary code officer, really going out into challenge neighborhoods, specific areas, and also areas where neighbors have come together themselves, and that goes directly to your point. We met recently with the Washington Escobedo neighborhood. They're very organized. Our code supervisor went out and spent an afternoon with 2 residents in that area. They're very interested in finding out what our codes are and then being proactive in their own community, working with their residents to bring properties into compliance. And another one is the Can Do neighborhood, where we have a code compliance working directly with those neighbors, trying to get, empowering the neighbors to do some eyes on the street code compliance work, and then we'll step in where we need to help.
Is that an outgrowth of that pilot program that we did with the CDC? Kind of like Dillis DeWitt, that was after he retired, he went and worked with the CDC for a little while and tried to, I mean, the whole concept was embedding code into the neighborhoods instead of us having to hire officers. We can, you know, scale this out a little broader. What, how do we make that sustainable? You know, the neighbor will go out and maybe take a few pictures, but how do we really get really what we want to accomplish is neighbors to be responsible for their own code issues. City shouldn't be the one calling them doing it. They should be taking care of stuff. And they should be communicating with each other. So what's kind of the...
Well, I think looking ahead to next year, seeing how well this has worked when we meet with those people in a neighborhood who are active and where you have a group that are really interested, I think in the year moving forward, trying to provide support for residents in the community to be able to kind of work on issues themselves. It's been really impressive how neighbors will help neighbors if they know what some of the issues are going on these properties, and so they will help. So what's the role of code? It's more education, outreach, maybe that mediation, and just helping neighbors kind of take care of themselves. The model that West Mesa CDC uses is working very well. We have a very experienced person out there looking at issues in the community, and he will work with property owners until he reaches a point where he can't get compliance. And then he brings it to the city, which allows code compliance officers who do understand the enforcement process to then step in and work, you know, through the legal process. But that's been great, the West Mesa CDC model. And to have more people like that would be very helpful.
What kind of costs are associated with that? I know we fund that program through CDBG. Did we hit the slide already that talks about where code officers are funded?
Yeah.
Yes. The next, okay. And not quite yet. Yeah, that's the next one.
Oh, the next one.
Okay. The other program that I wanted to talk to you about real quickly was the gentle reminder calling. This is the program where primarily bandit signs, the illegal signs that, you know, the tile shop or something else that go up on the street. And we've initiated a program in-house using the city's technology, so you have to bring something else in, where we complaints come in through our volunteer sign code. We put them in the gentle reminder calling. Businesses get calls how many times a day?
We're kind of sharing with other parts of the city that use this system, so we didn't put a new system in place. We're using one that's already there. They get up to 7 calls a day.
Yeah, and we've actually seen about a 20% compliance rate with that, which, you know, we'd like to see it a lot higher than that.
And it takes
that.
No staff time to do this. Yes.
Yeah.
They will call us back and let us know their signs have been removed, that we take them off the call list.
Yeah. We simply say, your business is in violation of sign code. Please take your sign down. It's very friendly.
We did talk to our sign sweep volunteers, who are probably the ones that are most aware of signage out there. They do support the program, but they also understand it's, you know, it's helping. But
yeah,
they're still needed.
Yeah, I've been driving around kind of watching out for that. I was talking to Grady the other day about it, and it seems to be working. I mean, I'd love the recording to be a little bit more forceful and frequent.
Well, we spent a lot of time on the text and the tone.
Look at that number up from 20%.
I had some initial ideas that involved the police department, but I was backed off of that. Just to answer, I'm sorry, sir.
Councilman Kavanaugh has a question. Thank you. And with regard to the signs and particularly the bandit sign issues, I know as part of the sweep that I've been on with the volunteers in the past and knowing from the police department, that there's been a very long-lasting criminal investigation going on because the bandit signs are either one company or really very, you know, small numbers of companies. And I guess I'm frustrated in that is still happening, and I haven't heard any progress along any lines to address the offenders. Can you give us any hope in this coming year that we're going to move to deal with the offending companies?
We have spent a significant amount of time. There's a couple in particular that have been egregious. Part of the problem is finding out who they are, who the company is, who the individual is. And it's amazing that, you know, we've got one in particular that was a huge problem. No human being would ever pick up the phone from the number that was listed. It was just you have to leave a message on a voicemail, and we did have the police department involved in that. But it's frustrating, and I don't think there's any real easy fix for that. Now, obviously, when it's a company that's identified, that's a reputable company, you know, we can go talk to them and say, stop it. But there do seem to be folks out there that are providing this service, and it's very difficult to
one would think with our fusion center, and I know they deal with a lot of big issues, but they also solve a lot of smaller crimes as well. I mean, this is not, the problem is not limited to Mesa. We know it's a small business, small number of operators. We know that they pay kids or people to put those signs up at midnight or between 9 and 5 in the morning. And, you know, I thought they were focusing on them to kind of get them to squeal in terms of who's doing it, because it really is it's a challenging problem for all the communities. And I really applaud our signed volunteers who help to work with it. Yeah. But it's frustrating when we know it's a small number of people that have multiple phone numbers.
Yes.
And they move you through the pyramid scheme to get to whatever it is.
Vice Mayor.
Before we go on to the people costs, could you give us a quick overview of what happens when we have these dangerous, dilapidated buildings, the amount of funds that are available? I'm hoping to hear back from my fellow council members that there may be an opportunity to increasing that fund for these buildings that sit burned out or other areas for months or years at times.
Yes, we have a system in place where the building official will go do an inspection, and if it is indeed a hazardous building, an unsafe structure, we post it, we provide a notice, we personally serve the owner, and they have 7 days in which to get back to us. And then often these cases are the owners are either not interested or they're gone. If one of these structures is in an area that is eligible for CDBG funding, we've had a very good relationship with the housing office. They will find those funds. We put that in the MOU each year that we want certain funds allocated for abatement.
How much is that?
$50,000, I think, yes. And so we use those funds to remove those structures. So that has worked very well. When a structure is outside the CDBG area, it's a little more difficult. However, we do have funds, and in the next year's request, we're asking for $10,000 to be used for abatement. And we will bring those, you know, when I was talking to Christine about this, if we run into a structure like that outside the CDBG area, then we'll come forward and request very specific funding for that demolition.
If I could follow up, my personal experience with this, working with staff, is those are such limited funds. When you talk about taking out a structure, when the city does it, they have to asbestos abatement and other things. Right. Literally, one building can kind of take the whole thing, and this is a huge city.
Yes.
And I don't know what they've had on the west side, but I know on the south side we've had lots of challenges. And so I know it's a funds that are held in a contingency, and so when they're needed, they kind of go to. I would hope that maybe as we go through these discussions, look for more aggressive funds along those lines, because my rationale or reasoning would be that what happens is they generate a lot of police calls, they generate a lot of follow-up calls. A particular issue in District 2 is individuals unable to tear down a site, but he's asked to board it up, and then what happens is homeless and drug individuals go in, take out the boards, they do activity, they do crime in the area, he's asked to board it back up, and it's a reoccurring costly process. And so hopefully we'll be able to find some more funds to be able to take out more of those
I attended a conference last week, and I was with code officers from throughout the state, and there are some jurisdictions that have code language that actually specifically address abandoned buildings that are abandoned up to 2 years and gives the city more authority to take action. So I'd really like to work with our legal department on that.
Yeah, because just quickly, Mayor, Vice Mayor, because when I hear you talking, maybe we can look for additional funds for demolitions, but those would have to fall. I think today we're only allowed to go in when those are deemed a, what's the term you use?
Unsafe structure.
Unsafe structure.
Right.
Now, what you, I mean, I was kind of hearing what you're describing may be more of an abandoned building. Maybe it's not, well, the residents probably considered an unsafe structure, but structurally it probably is fine, but it becomes a nuisance because of the activity.
Yes.
So maybe we could look at this other code, because that would then give us opportunity to do something.
Yes. Okay. I'd like to come back to you with that.
Councilman Kavanaugh?
Well, just to respond to the Vice Mayor, a very large example on the west side is at northwest corner of Allen School and Southern. And I know those are not abandoned buildings, but they're vacant buildings that continue to deteriorate over time. And I'm just wondering, again, within the industry, what are the best practices of communities where you have not abandoned, but you have vacant buildings that are continuing to deteriorate? At what point do have other communities decided enough is enough that they can have an ordinance in place or to permit action to deal with property owners who let the buildings continue to deteriorate? Because that particular example I cited, it's like I would be surprised if those buildings are habitable at this point. I mean, you've done a tremendous amount of work with property owners in cleaning up the exterior of the buildings, but I think the reality is if I were a prospective tenant, no one would want, in their right mind, would want to lease those spaces.
Yes, sir. If we wanted to move on to the funding model, currently we have 3 code officers that are in the general fund and 4 in that are funded by CDBG. And what that means effectively is that 4 officers can only work in 15% of the city, which is the sort of the central corridor and the older areas of the city. It's the areas that under the HUD program are low to moderate income. What that leaves is 3 code officers for the entire rest of the city. So, again, that's what results in the 171 open cases per code officer. They do a tremendous job out there. One of the things that we've tried to do, and if we look at the stats, this last winter was fairly wet, so there were a lot of weeds out there, and we've done this a couple of times over the last couple of years. We simply send out letters and say, hey, we have reason to believe that your weeds are overgrown. And it's amazing the level of compliance that, you know, people will get out and say, okay, let me hire the 17-year-old kid and get the weeds down. So that's actually, it's increased the number of cases. It's solved the problem, but it really hasn't taken an awful lot of code time to do it. So when we find things like that are pretty easy to deal with without opening a case and going through the whole enforcement process, we tried to do that.
Excuse me, Mayor?
Yeah. Oh. Dina, go ahead.
Christine, I had a question. A few weeks ago, or maybe a month or so ago, we redefined what was in the CDBG area. Do you recall that conversation? It kind of expanded what we were looking at and named different areas, low to moderate areas.
And yeah, we've been working with community and Tammy Albright's group, housing, and we looked at the census data. I was quite surprised, and I think this is what our conversation was, that I had expected that CDBG eligible area would increase. We put together a letter, our GIS folks put together a map based on the census data because the state wasn't moving very quickly on it. We actually submitted that, and I don't know that even as yet that HUD has approved that, but based on our analysis of the census data and identifying the low to moderate income eligible areas, it really has not changed an awful lot. We had expected it would have increased, but it didn't. Does that answer your question?
No, and I'll find that map from the presentation and maybe we'll talk about it later.
So I think, Councilman, if your point is, I think the point is, if the boundaries have changed where it's HUD eligible, then we will move.
Oh,
we can
absolutely
move our code officers into
those
areas.
Yes,
absolutely.
But it was a presentation, a few weeks ago, where you actually showed like big areas around Falcon Field were CDBG areas, and other areas that hadn't been in the CDBG areas were, and I don't recall what that discussion was about.
Yeah, there are some areas, particularly up north of Falcon Field, where there's very little residential up there, so they're largely empty or industrial parks that haven't yet developed. I think that's what you're talking about.
Yeah. No, that's okay. But I just wondered, like you said, if that does get expanded, obviously these code officers could go more places.
Okay, we'll certainly follow up with you and Tammy on that, if that's okay.
That sounds great. Thank you.
Okay. And again, as Laura talked about, we do have a temporary code officer in CDBG, and that's really, Councilmember Finder, to go to your point, where we try to identify specific neighborhoods, and much smaller than building strong neighborhoods. What Laura and I have talked about are very focused areas, even a block at a time or two blocks, working with solid waste to get dumpsters in there, with police, with fire, with neighborhood outreach, and really try to go in and work on an educational campaign initially that, you know, you've got all this junk and problems in your area, and can the city provide some resources to help get those neighborhoods cleaned up, to provide education, and then kind of keep up with them, not just abandon them and move on. So that's kind of the goal of that temporary person, to focus on really small areas that have big problems. And a couple of, I think, phenomenal examples.
This, I guess, maybe more of a question for Mr. Brady than anyone. Is there any way to change this dynamic this fiscal year to where we can shift a couple more code officers into the general fund and out of CDBG? Because I think we did that. Going back to what you talked about with the West Mesa CDC, with the other neighborhoods you mentioned, Can-Do Neighborhood and others, I think there's opportunities in CDBG to really expand our forces with a lot less money. Doing it through CDBG, little job creation and efforts, because there's a lot of neighbors that I've talked to that are retired or you know, that are looking for little part-time things to do, and they're my frequent flyers that call and complain about a lot of different things, and it's like you can engage them. And so, you know, if you could look at the budget and see if we couldn't figure out how to shift a couple out of code and into the general fund to be able to cover larger areas of the city. And then I think there's some ideas out there percolating for taking up that CDBG that could really take this program and expand quite a bit and really give you the resources that we need to cover the whole city. So you can make that consideration. We can talk more about that later.
If I could just add one thing on that. Okay. West Mesa CDC and I have actually talked about that starting 2 years ago, that it would be great to get more of those folks out there, and we'd actually worked on collaborating to try to get more CDBG money for additional code op, the private, you know, like homeowner association, that kind of thing. And unfortunately, the CDBG money is going down, not up, so that we really were not successful in getting more officers out there in the community.
And we've identified some people that would be perfect.
I think there are plenty of people
doing that. Yeah, and you know, so that's why I think this year, if we could evaluate. You know, we got to make the break eventually, and it's, I know it's tough, and it's a tough budget year, but this is something that's been important from a quality of life standpoint for a lot of Mesa's residents.
Okay, and just to show a couple of real quick pictures of successes of code officers, this first one I'm particularly proud of. It was one code officer, and actually, Councilmember Richens, I think you went out there. It was an individual who was simply incapable for medical reasons of taking care of his property. The code officer, all on her own, got a very large group together of neighbors.
Can
they
we
went
name
out
her by name because she, I mean, she deserves.
That was Lynn Satterway.
Yeah. She was incredible.
She
the
was
amount of time
yep.
out there on a Saturday, organizing a lot of folks. I mean, yeah, she deserves high praise.
And, yes.
So you know,
she definitely.
We'll give some credit where it's due there.
She definitely does, but she pretty much took this on all on her own. And she got neighbors involved, she got faith community involved, and they just helped this gentleman out. He pretty much stayed in the house. I guess eventually he came out. But in one afternoon, they made this kind of a difference. They even painted the house, cleaned up the weeds, cleaned up the junk in the backyard. This is another one, just a backyard. This is his backyard, where it was kind of a hoarder mentality, where there was just all kinds of stuff. The volunteer group got it all cleaned up, and the lower right portion is the backyard after it was all cleaned up. To go to the discussion on burned and abandoned buildings, this is one where we were actually successful in getting it declared a hazardous structure. It was structurally unsound, obviously. Code officers worked with the abatement money, and the next slide, we're able to get it totally demoed and back to vacant ground. Wanted to go on to environmental and sustainability real quickly. As you know, we've been here numerous times with Mr. Boucher. He has successfully spent down his $4.2 million of the stimulus fund. That's all been used for energy conservation programs. We've saved approximately $4.8 million kilowatt hours in energy savings, which 185 kilowatt hours with renewable energy production, the solar panels that we put on. That equates to about a $400,000 decrease in actual dollars spent on energy. And we've obtained $248,479 in SRP rebates. That was the first time we've gone after SRP rates, so we were pretty excited about that. We're working with the city manager's office we've developed a fund that the energy savings will be rolled back into that fund so they can continue to fund energy efficiency programs going on to the future. The whole idea of our approach to that stimulus money is that it would be leveraged long-term so we could continue to use it for energy efficiency programs. Two of the projects that are on the books for this next fiscal year, significant improvements at the convention center, everything from lighting to the HVAC system and also the main library. We've also been successful in continuing to get grants. A couple I wanted to point out, we received $400,000 in brownfields grants that were used to do the environmental assessments along the next route of the light rail. Those have been completed, and we have $50,000 in brownfields grant to do the environmental assessment on Buckhorn Bath, which is just in the process of getting started. We also have been successful in continuing to receive from the Bureau of Reclamation the Grass to Xeriscape grants over the 2 years. That'll total about $50,000. And also we received a $50,000 grant for municipal plumbing enhancements. Another one of the successes, the iMesa success, the mug garden over next to the court building is a real success. It's become a neighborhood gathering place, and Kathy McDonald took the lead along with Donna DeFrancesco and really making that happen, along with a whole bunch of other city staffers that worked on it. One of the other things that's rapidly making progress is the solar installation on the Fiesta police station. So it's that building is going up very quickly, and there will be solar panels on that to provide energy for the building. Final slide here is our financial kind of high-level summary. For the most part, expenditures have stayed the same on personal services. Again, the permanent staffing has remained pretty constant. The other services, that's where the temporary workers come in, where we bring them in as needed, but it's not a full-time FTE. Let me see. Other than that, it's, you know, the budget's pretty much flatline compared to where we have been the last couple of years. Any further questions?
Any questions? Councilor Summers?
Just an observation on that backyard, because it drew my attention to it. I'm not sure that really is a hoarding situation. I've been involved in hoarding situations, and I think Alex is too, firsthand. That one struck me not so much as hoarding, but which is collecting, right, but just the junk that he needed to get rid of that he put in the backyard for convenience but had really no way of doing it. There are many times, and I've had this problem too, where I have materials I need to throw out or I need to recycle. They're too big to go in the trash barrel. You know, you do a yard cleanup, you cut it up, throw it out little bits at a time, but it accumulates, seems faster than you can get rid of it. One of the programs that you have that could help combat that is to providing those big dumpsters. Right. And we do that as part of our Building Strong Neighborhoods mm-hmm. effort. I would like us to look at how we might be able to provide that to neighborhoods more liberally.
Right. And
progressively.
We've worked with Solid Waste on that, and they have been wonderful in helping us out. And that's really what I was talking about
And I understand the cost of this, and I don't think it's a big cost. I think it's $100. The problem is that somebody wants to use it. They have to put down $100, and then all their neighbors freeload on it.
Right.
And that just doesn't seem fair. And if there's any, I'd like us to look at this program and see how we could really expand it so and provide it to neighborhoods where maybe we do it once a year, once every few years, or how we can get these communities involved more, because I think it would help neighbors reduce the amount of clutter in their side yards and their backyards if we could just provide those dumpsters for them at a cost, and maybe there's some way to offset it by looking at the materials that they provide, because I know that we set up separate dumpsters for materials, basically, you know, tires go to one because we can recycle those, and recyclables into another, and then trash in a third. Mm-hmm. I think there are opportunities maybe to offset some of those costs in by recycling that material, but it would go a long way to reduce the clutter in neighbors' yards, and I think it's truly a quality of life program that meets our strategic initiatives.
We'll work with the Solid Waste Management Group on that and see what we can do. Anything else?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next item is public information and communications. Mr. Wright, welcome back.
Thank you, Mayor. It's good to be here again.
I'm sure it is.
Steve Wright, Director of Public Information and Communications, and I have Glenn Steven, who is the station manager for Channel 11. Just going to start off really quick talking about some of the innovations from last year. First thing, and I'm going to probably have Glenn jump off of the PowerPoint really quick and go out to masonnow.org. Masonnow.org is our electronic newsroom that was developed after we'd gone out to the media outlets and talked to them about what is it that they need from us and how everything's going. And one of the things that they said a couple of years ago was that because of their resources and the challenges they were having with resources, sometimes it was hard for them to get out to the East Valley for some of our events. And we said, well, we can provide B-roll for you and other content. And they said, yeah, but it, you know, we need to figure out a way to get that. And especially because they said, if we don't use it for our television production, we'll definitely use it on our website. So we came back and started brainstorming and decided that we needed to create an electronic newsroom that was much more functional for the media. We recently went on a tour with the media and kind of reviewed what we had created. We launched it last year in February during the CNN GOP primary debate, presidential debate, and had over 500 hits during the couple days that we had it up. So really quick, I'm just going to have Glenn go through and show you. This is just a couple minutes, show you kind of what the media sees and why this is a benefit to them.
So basically, when press releases are put out by the Public Information Office, this system picks those up automatically and aggregates them into one place so that the media has one central place to go to find whatever press releases the city's putting out. And then once the event is over, we come back, we're taking photos and putting high-res photos up. We're recording audio sound bites for the radio stations. We're recording B-roll for the TV stations, and then we come back and put all that in and associated with that press release. So when they get the press release that says, you know, after 4 p.m. media will be available, they can come in here and download and preview all of the high-res photos, listen to the clips, and KTAR, a lot of the stations are utilizing this media to publicize what we're doing. The raw footage is up there for the TV stations so that if they can't come out and cover it, they pull down these clips, edit their packages together, and we've been tracking it, and it is being used. They are pulling this stuff and covering things that otherwise wouldn't have coverage. And like Steve said, when we went back and showed it to them, they said, we're using it in this capacity, but here's some things that would help us use it even better. And so this next year, we're going to implement a lot of the suggestions that they gave to us to hopefully get even more use of it.
Yeah, and it was interesting. There's no other city really in the country that is using this type of technology. Some of them have something that, for example, Gilbert just rolled something out. It's very different. Our intent in this is that a reporter can sit at their desk if need be, pull down the B-roll and it's raw video and actually create their story without ever having to leave their desk area. And we're trying to really facilitate their ability to cover our stories. We also just kind of aggregated into one location for the media information about initiatives. Click on leadership. Over on leadership side, we have links to all of your web pages so they can easily get to the information. Under the links, if we go down to data center, this is really a lot of times they're asking for information from us, and so they can go to the data center and it takes them over to the economic development data center where all the demographics and that information is provided. So it's just really makes it easy for them to get all that information. Our gallery is photos, both of council members and just various sites. This is one of the areas where they ask us to enhance this. And so in our enhancements for 13-14, as we expand our e-newsroom, we will have raw video footage, B-roll of things that they've requested. For example, they said we'd love to have pictures of fire trucks and PD, you know, vehicles moving. Well, we had a story one time. This is kind of what got us talking about this. We had a story one time that ran about Mesa Fire, but one of the TV stations didn't have B-roll of Mesa Fire, so they had a Phoenix fire truck rolling. And we caught that, and it kind of annoyed me. And so... Yeah, yeah. You waved when you went by. So anyhow, we are working with them. They definitely have some specific footage that they're looking for, and so we're going to create that footage and put that out there on the link as well. Is there anything else on here we want to show? Okay, we'll go back. So back to the 12-13 innovations. We're continuing to have success with our sponsorship and underwriting programs. This is both with our utility bill insert program as well as the, we call them edumercials on Mesa Channel 11. And in fact, those programs have allowed us to, over the last couple of years, purchase some of the equipment that we've needed, even though the budget didn't allow us because of the restraints on the general fund. We were able to make some purchases that were very much needed, including the third innovation under 12-13, which was to create our media room or our little small studio upstairs. And the intent of that studio, and some of you I think have used it, is really to enhance and facilitate the video and podcasting type things for social media and for your websites. It's not always easy for you to run down to Channel 11. They may not be there, but we have a council PIO who has the capability because of his background to do podcasts and broadcasts. And so we created that studio close to your area so that that can be used. And then just in 13-14, we've listed the 5-year capital improvement program for Channel 11 that we're going to discuss briefly here. Mainly the reason that is in there is because as we complete our transition to digital format, that is going to allow us to spend time with innovation as opposed to constantly trying to use baling wire and duct tape to fix the analog and antiquated equipment that we have. We already discussed the enhancements to the newsroom. And then, Glenn, just if you want to chat really briefly about the mobile streaming.
Yeah. Currently, Channel 11 is available online at macechannel11.com. We archive all of the council meetings and study sessions. You can watch them live on the web. We've started to roll out some mobile integration for that, so you can watch it on your mobile devices. It's not completed yet, but we're partway down that process, but we want to complete that. The other thing that we really want to do is deliver Channel 11 more than just on your computer and through the cable systems. And we're working on delivering the channel through some set-top box streaming devices like Roku, where people can access it regardless of the boundary that they live in, and they don't have to be sitting at their computer or looking at a phone to do it. They can watch Channel 11 the same way they would Hulu or Netflix through set-top boxes on their TVs, and we think that that will open, you know, a much broader audience, not just in Mesa, but the people that are temporary residents of Mesa would be able to much easier access information and see what's going on at Channel 11, not just in terms of what's happening live, but we'd also provide the archive, council meetings, and other content that we're producing, so it creates more of an on-demand Channel 11 as well.
Okay. Last year, the notable awards that we received were from the City County Communications and Marketing Association, which is also called 3CMA. It's a professional association for municipal marketing and communications professionals. We received a President's Award for Outstanding Marketing Program, the Savvy Award, which is the highest award that they give for outstanding recurring event for the Arizona Celebration of Freedom, and then we also received an Award of Excellence for Twitter Town Hall. This slide really just kind of highlights all the things that we do in Mesa Channel 11 and in the PIO office, including our graphic design. And it's interesting. In 2009, when we went through the budget reductions that everybody else did, we were significantly impacted. 50% of our staff and budget went away, and we were forced to rethink how we do business and respond to the city manager and this council's direction to find new ways to do business. So we did a lot of cross training, and so we have employees that can do more than just one thing. As far as we have some that are in Channel 11. In fact, Jesse's, who is our management too, who also does our website and that type of thing, is running their character generation upstairs during these meetings. But we've also been able to be more efficient in how we do business. We use a lot of interns, ASU interns, both paid and for credit interns, whereas before we didn't use a lot of those, and we've had a lot of success with that. We have two interns right now that are working for us, as well as the interns that we use from Cronkite. Yes.
Councilor Kavanaugh.
Steve, just a question to that with the interns. Have you been in discussions, or do you see opportunities for internships with the new colleges downtown?
Absolutely. In fact, we had a meeting, I think it was facilitated by Councilmember Kavanaugh, with Benedictine University. Had three or four of their folks that came over, and we spent a good 2 hours with them. They're very interested. They have a communications degree that'll be being offered, and are very interested in partnering with us. And I know that we've had some initial discussions with Wilkes and Westminster as well. So definitely looking towards that, and it'll be a lot easier because they'll be right downtown.
Absolutely.
So,
Mayor.
Councilor Richards.
This has been a really enlightening presentation. I'm impressed with the amount of innovation that you guys are constantly pushing, you know, the tech innovation. And I think back to the IT discussion we had last week, and you know, so how does what you do integrate in with the IT? I mean, you guys have, where do you host Mesa Now, your Mesa Now site? How do you do that?
I'm going to let Glenn talk about it, but one of the things that we have to do, we host that, and that's our site that we manage with Channel 11 and through Channel 11's network because of the content. The video streaming and how we load that up, it needs to be hosted through that. But I'll let Glenn kind of explain where we do that.
Yeah, one of the challenges we face is video's big, and it's the files are big. The amount of bandwidth we need to move those files is big, and in order for the media to be able to access that quickly, they need to be able to pull down files through bandwidth that we don't have, you know, available to us through city resources. So we currently do a kind of a co-hosting through our Mesa Channel 11 network, through some connectivity through Cox, and then we have a server presence in a facility called IO Data in downtown Phoenix, which gives us the bandwidth we need for the media to be able to pull that information much faster than they could if they were pulling them from our local servers.
Oh, okay. So it's a combination of in-house and out-of-house stuff.
Correct.
Making that work, okay. Good. I mean, the great job with the innovation. I mean, it's just for the amount of, I saw the budget at the end, and I was like, what? You guys are doing all this for that? It was pretty impressive.
Thank you.
Okay, just really quick, I'm going to run through these next slides fast. This is the data for these different components. And the important thing to note is that these numbers don't seem too large, except when you realize that the people that are accessing this are the reporters, so it's the media, which is a smaller group, and businesses or residents that are engaged and that either aren't watching Channel 11 actually on Cox Cable or don't have Cox Cable, and so they're accessing the information through MesaChannel11.com, which is the website, or through MesaNow.org. So just really quick, this is kind of a summary of why our department exists. We exist to provide timely and accurate information to Mesa residents, visitors, and businesses, and to the media about the city, the programs and services that we offer. And as it says on the slide, that we're a key component of the transparency for government, because we provide different mediums for residents, media, and those folks to access the information. You can see we have 25,000 views, Mesa Channel 11 streaming, and that's the council and study sessions, and then just watching Channel 11. And then Channel 11 via Cox is available to approximately 90,000 households in the city.
We should mention, too, that with CenturyLink providing cable, we've already been in the process of putting the equipment together and getting our channel on the CenturyLink network, which will only expand the number of viewers that way as well.
This slide just talked about masonnow.org, and since we've already reviewed that, I'm going to go ahead and skip that. This is the important slide with regard to the strategic upgrade and investment for Channel 11. The average age of the equipment in Channel 11 is between 15 and 20 years old. And that's in an industry where the standard is 5 to 7 years. So we're kind of at a critical point with Channel 11 equipment. We've done really well during these lean times of holding it together. However, in the last 12 months, we've started to see some issues come up. And this is just some of the different things that we've had. We were unable to broadcast a live session because we had a digital to analog converter that went out. We've had some issues with fluctuation of audio, and I know sometimes you guys have experienced that, and it's frustrating for you, and you ought to see the control room when that's happening. Everybody's bouncing around because we know that that people are looking, trying to figure out what's going on, so it can be kind of fun to be in there when something like that happens. I'm going to have Glenn just briefly talk about this slide. This shows where our choke points and our issues are in how we deliver and where the possible problems might come up.
Yeah, basically, there's, you know, we send information from the council chambers to our master control, and from master control to Cox. We don't have CenturyLink in here, but they would be one of them, and then MesaChannel11.com. And each one of those A, B, and C legs of this thing has potential points of failure. And so, you know, we could have great things going on in the council chambers in terms of technology and equipment, but if master control and the way we get that to the cable company is having issues, doesn't matter what we're doing over here, it's not making it to the final destination, which is the residents and the community. And so we're trying to deal with issues at all stages of potential failure and make sure that we're current so that that doesn't happen.
Okay, and then this is just the adopted budget for 12-13 and the proposed budget. And the note on this is that it doesn't include the five-year capital investment plan for Channel 11, but you have that document that was provided to you. And so we're open for questions now. Anybody has any questions?
Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you, and Steve, I really appreciate the presentation, and Glenn, and the five-year capital improvement program. If the council so chose, I know we might be discussing whether or not we're going to be doing a bond issue this fall or the next year. Is would this be something that we could consider rather than spreading it out over 5 years, including the Channel 11 needs in as part of our communication needs in a bond issue?
Yeah, Mayor, Councilmember Kavanaugh. Typically with bonds, because of the term of the bonds, we usually look for something that is a capital improvement. Has, well, I guess he's proven up. He's used his equipment for 15 to 20 years, but I don't think it's not intended. As soon as I was getting ready to say that, I was realizing, well, I really think equipment like this is not typically gone through a used as a bond program. Our bond council, was not very wouldn't recommend it. So I think what our goal here is to try to find a way, and working with Steve and Glenn, and when we developed the five-year program, it was trying to anticipate when the most critical need to replace those. So we've tried to work carefully so that time it now. We've had some equipment that's failed sooner than was anticipated. So then Glenn goes back, and obviously we have to purchase that equipment. So
And then we just have to reprioritize. But I think we feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. It's not ideal, but we feel comfortable. We've got a plan. If we will make that investment every year, and that's the key, right, is to stay on top of it every year, we'll be able to get to a point. And it doesn't end. It really doesn't end. I mean, we'll add on again in 5 years because equipment that we replaced, you know, 2 years ago will now need to be replaced, you know, at the end of this five-year program. So that's what we're going to try to do, is keep kind of a steady and contribution into this plan, so that each year we just budget that going forward, and hopefully that'll over time kind of get us up to where we need to be.
Right. We had that with our vehicles.
Right.
We have
we talked about that with the radios.
With the radios
yeah,
also.
Radios. Yeah.
Doing a radio replacement. Councilmember Richens.
Yeah. Actually, I forgot what I was going to say.
Mayor and Councilmember Kavanaugh, to what City Manager said, when we presented this to the City Manager and budget, one of the things that they said is, okay, but how, you know, what do we need to do? How much do we need to put into the budget when this is over, so we don't get in this situation again? And Glenn looked at that, and so, you know, we're comfortable, as City Manager mentioned, that when this 5 years is over, that we have a number that's kind of an ongoing maintenance number that allow us to make ongoing changes as we deem necessary, so that we don't get in a situation like this again.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I will say that going around not only the state but the country, and I have this obsession with looking at public access channels, you know, in my view, we do better than anyone I've seen as far as quality, as far as quantity, as far as substance of programming. This is becoming a much more important every day as media changes throughout of communicating and disseminating information. And so I commend you for what you've done. You've done it with fewer resources than others. You've used, I didn't see any baling wire and chewing gum in your budget.
Yeah.
Duct tape's in there. But I know you've used quite a bit of that. And I commend you for the work you've done. It's very, very professional, very, very, and very informative, and without being preachy, which I think is important. You know, this isn't meant to be a cheerleading station. It's to be an information station, and I think you strike a very, very, a very good balance between you know, being the home team announcers and just saying what's going on, and that's what our citizens need. And it's I really appreciate the work you do.
Thank you,
Councilman Richens. You remember now?
Yeah, I remember now.
Good. Okay.
I like that you guys have been kind of leading the way on the technological edge of, you know, you've been innovating well. And I look at the five-year capital program that you sent. You know, there's going to be some changes. How do you anticipate folding in the CenturyLink network? How do you anticipate folding in some of the other technologies that, I mean, you can't even be aware of them yet, but into that five-year plan? How is that plan set up to evolve as technology evolves? Because you guys seem to adapt very quickly.
I mean, the biggest hurdle we face right now is when CenturyLink comes to us and says we'd like to tie in, and we tell them that we're still analog, they say, well, that's a problem. So just getting everything out of the analog world and into the digital world opens a lot of doors for us. And what right now we spend such a huge amount of time spinning our wheels trying to make things work, to get things done, versus taking that time to innovate and look ahead. You know, we're kind of in a survival mode as opposed to a looking forward mode. And I think once we get things where we're digital, we're interfacing with all the other technologies the way we need to, things are working smoothly and efficiently, then it gives us a little bit more time to produce more content, look at other ways to innovate, and do some of these other things. And a lot of our time right now really is spent on the other side of this. I'd like to get over that hump a little bit.
So the key is the conversion from analog to digital.
That is the main
absolutely
key to this.
And I guess that includes the HD-type broadcasts and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and right now we do shoot in HD. We don't deliver it because we have no medium to deliver it, but we wouldn't even be able to think about that until we get to a digital platform, and that gets us there.
Yeah, and the other thing that I will say, Mayor and Councilmember Richens, is Glenn every year goes to the National Association of Broadcasters meeting in Las Vegas, and that is where all the new and up-and-coming technology and all the different gizmos and all that kind of stuff is. And he spent a couple days there this year and came back. And he comes back just giddy because of everything that he's seen. And so then we have to figure out, okay, how do we do that within the budget that we have? So,
but even that brought a lot of new stuff to the table. And I've kind of rethought some of the strategy based on that. So, you know, just staying plugged into the pulse of that and being current with our being digital changes everything for us.
Probably helps that you're significantly younger than Steve, too. So, you know, it's those young folks that take up that technology so quick.
Thanks.
Councilor Kavanaugh.
Thank you. One of the issues that received extensive discussion at the National League of Cities Board of Directors meeting in both March and in January was to how to integrate what we call NLC TV with our local cable channels. And that is one of the things that one of the priority areas that National League of Cities wants to work on with our member communities. So hopefully we can get you engaged with their media folks there to see if our programming equipment is compatible, because they want to they really want to really engage local communities with work that the NLC is doing. I know that it's part of NLC TV there. I was interviewed during the conference, but I don't know. I don't think we had any way to get that message or that interview or that information for that discussion project to Channel 11. But that is something that is on the National League of Cities agenda for this year. So hopefully, at least to be aware of that they're going to be coming to us, asking us to participate with them to be able to help add information from what they produce onto our local stations.
Absolutely. And to tie into that, I'm a member of a local group that we actually put together ourselves. It's Arizona Government Access Managers, and all of the Channel 11 equivalents of what I do, we meet on a quarterly basis, talk about what the other cities are doing. Is there ways that we can collaborate, share resources, share content? And I think this fits right into that model of, you know, if there's something that pertains to Mesa residents that we're not doing, you know, collaborating with those people to make that happen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Here reports on meetings and conferences. Vice Mayor.
Thank you. I wanted to express appreciation to the executive staff that had the opportunity to go through some inclusion training sponsored and put on by a Boeing company, a great one of the major private sector employers in Mesa, and we appreciate people taking the time and going through that. So thanks so much.
Thank you. Councilman Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. Tuesday, I was proud to represent the city at a major announcement in downtown Phoenix on the problem of dealing with homeless animals. And this was an announcement of a new program called Fix, Adopt, and Save. And our city's animal control office strongly supports this initiative. And the announcement was important in that it came with funding from the Pulliam Trust and the PetSmart Trust, Arizona Community Foundation. Councilmember Richards was at the event, I think, as well, and it was really a remarkable collaboration of organizations that have been working on this, which will be providing millions of dollars to help enhance the adoption of programs, the trap, spay, neuter, trap, neuter, release programs that we have. And Mesa, along with Phoenix and Glendale, will be one of the focus cities that will be benefiting from this this grant program. We were there, and it's appropriate since we just had Channel 11 that we had issued a challenge. Vice Mayor Bill Gates and I were there, and we've issued a challenge to the other Valley cities to come together with all of our Channel 11s to help produce some spots on this. Vice Mayor Gates is a Republican and a dog owner. I'm a Democrat and a cat owner, and we have some ideas of some fun commercials. It won't be anywhere near as good as Mayor Stanton and Mayor Smith with their YouTube success, but we hope to engage our Channel 11s to in a way to get the message out to our communities, because particularly in Mesa, we've got the challenge of feral cats in many, many of our neighborhoods, and so we hope this new program will help bring resources to bear to assist us on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Glad to see cats and dogs and donkeys and elephants.
Collaborating together.
lions and lambs, what's this world coming to? All getting together. Yesterday, the Vice Mayor and I had an opportunity to be out at Able Engineering for a special visit by Dr. Rebecca Blank, who's the acting U.S. Secretary of Commerce. She is the top one, and she came specifically to Gateway Airport and to Able to highlight this incredible company and what it represents as far as economic commercial strategy and advanced manufacturing. Able will be officially moving into their new facility next week. They had just enough to sort of wet the palate yesterday, but it's a beautiful, beautiful building. It's been 2-3 years in the making, and the great thing is when we agreed as a city to back this project and to be primarily the lead partner in this project, Able, who has been operating out of a Phoenix facility for a number of years and was actually on its way out of state to move operations out of state, we had Able commit to a minimum of 250 jobs. And at that time, I think they had about 200, just over 200 jobs. And we said, if we're going to do this, you need to commit to 250 jobs. Well, the day they'll move in, they'll have well in excess of 350, and they have dozens of job openings, postings, and they couldn't hire because they didn't have any place to put them in their old facility. They anticipate they'll be to 450 within a few months, pushing towards 600, 650. Great success story. Should be used as a model for partnering and for the type of industry we want, not only in Mesa, but in Arizona. The great thing about Able is they're just above $60-plus million a year in revenue, headed to $80 million. They do business in 50 companies. They export to 50 different countries around the world. So they do domestic work. They do a lot of export work. They very high wage, very technical because they deal in the aviation and aerospace business, and just a great story. And a great company to have here, and we're excited that acting Secretary of Commerce Blank was here yesterday and made a major announcement on a new initiative from the president on advancing these types of activities through manufacturing and other activities. So we're just glad to be not only be part of that, but yesterday at least be the center of the commercial world. Councilmember Summers.
Mayor, I, unfortunately, I wasn't able to attend that. It wasn't because I wasn't in town, but I had been stuck. I was in Chicago this week attending an NFPA summit. I was invited to come and present Mesa's Neighborhood Stabilization Program, part of our NSP program. We purchased a number of single-family, multifamily homes. Multifamily homes were transferred to our private sector partners, but we included a number of fire and life safety upgraded features in those homes, and they asked me to come to talk about that because it was truly a unique application of NSP dollars that staff did, and it was something that drew national attention in the life safety community. But on my way back, I was stuck in the American Airlines fiasco, and so ended up spending an extra night, unwanted night in Chicago, which normally would be fine, but it wasn't exactly the best hotel that I ended up staying with. So I was still 2 hours behind, so I missed the meeting. But what was interesting about the grand opening there, that something I found fascinating, is if you recall 4 years ago when President Obama was in town announcing the NSP program, CNN, in one of their headlines, described Mesa as a poster child for the foreclosure problem, pointing to the foreclosures and abandoned homes as part of it because we are such a large residential community. Here we are 4 years later because of a lot of hard work by the council and by staff and by many in the private sector to get beyond that. And we are, the announcement by the Deputy Secretary coming here to be part of the ribbon cutting for Able Engineering. And their announcement is Mesa as a model for economic development and manufacturing jobs. What a turnaround we have had in some very difficult times over the last 4 years. And I feel that I need to draw attention to that and all the work that everybody has been doing. Finally, my last meeting was last night. I did wake up in time to attend my last meeting, which was the Wilkes University Advisory Board. If they are they're ready to roll out their programs, master's in business administration and master's degree in teaching. It was a phenomenal board. I am working actively, as I know as Dennis Kavanaugh is on the Benedictine University Advisory Board, working actively for this tremendous program that we have brought in to encourage higher education in Mason, Arizona, to make sure that that's a successful program. So if you are interested in an MBA or you're interested in a master's in teaching, I encourage you to take a look at Wilkes University. Great school, very much a hands-on school with their projects and their education, smaller classroom sizes. I think you'll find it enjoyable. So take a look. You can always send me an email if you can't find any other information. I will be glad to connect you to the right folks who they'll show you around the programs. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Mr. Brady.
Mr. Mayor, Council, we have a couple events this weekend, or actually on Saturday. Saturday we have the Household Hazardous Waste event at the Center Street location. I believe that starts at 8 o'clock in the morning. And then also we have a Celebrate Mesa free event. I invite residents to come and enjoy a lot of food and fun, games, city departments will be there, and that starts at 3 p.m. on Saturday at Pioneer Park. So invite everybody out to that. Thank you.
Okay. Councilor Richards.
I just, before, I had an item before I jumped in. I was asked by the National League of Cities to be an online commentator for a movie called, it was a viewing of the movie Detropia, which was it really illustrates the malaise of the city of Detroit and everything they're going through as a shrinking city. And Councilmember Summers' comments about manufacturing housing, they asked me to comment because of the success we're having and kind of keeping on top of that and looking at Detroit. But it was fascinating. There's people from all over the country that were part of this online viewing, and they'd ask questions, and it was like this giant chat room during a movie. But it was, you can find the movie online. It's called Detropia. It's really stark, and if we're not careful about making sure we have a diversified economy, and we have too many eggs in one basket, it was startling and scary to see what Detroit's going through right now. And our city is about the same population as Detroit now, and about the same size as square miles from a square mileage standpoint. So Mesa needs to learn lessons from things like that. Thanks.
So stay away from the egg industry, is that what you're saying? That's what I heard.
No, the Hickman family is always welcome in Mesa.
I heard it's a shell of a business to be in. That wasn't supposed to be a yoke. Okay.
Move to adjourn quickly.
We have a motion to adjourn. Second from Councilmember Richens. All in favor say. Oh, wait. Do we have any requests to speak, Ms. Mickelson?
No requests, Mayor.
Okay. The motion is still on the table. A second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned. Thank you.
Bye-bye.